Hey everybody, welcome back to the Nidus Anarchy Series. I'm your host, Adam, the CIO of Nidus, and today I am super honored to have Jim Schlexer, Dr. Jim Schlexer, actually. Your book says Jim Schlexer, but you are now doctor, so I don't want to leave that out. That's an important part. Author of Great CEOs Are Lazy. I was actually just talking about this book, just plugging it out because I thought it was an amazing book. And then when you commented on the post, I was like, oh my God, let's see if we can get you on here. So I'm really excited to have you here. Personally, this is me just being a nerd at this point because this book is amazing. So first, before we get into all that, why don't you kind of tell everyone a little bit about yourself and your background and kind of how you came to be?
Yeah, no problem. So background of engineering and MBA, and kind of went through all the seats in a corporate environment over time, up to, you know, starting to run companies when I was a young guy, 29 years old. And basically my whole career, I've run businesses. It's all I've ever done. Small, medium, large, public, private. Almost 20 years ago at this point, I got off the corporate track, decided to start a CEO advisory business, CEO peer group. And that's what I do now. And, you know, one of the things I found as I was interviewing CEOs that there are some really high performing CEOs that don't put in 80 hours a week. And yet there's some low performing CEOs that put in gobs and gobs of hours. I'm like, okay, hours are not correlated to success here or performance. It's something else. And that's really what the book is about. What is that something else that the ones that work normal amounts of hours and get great results do differently than the ones that are busting their butt and not getting the results they want?
Yep. And so I found you from a random Instagram, like 30-second clip of some car wash guy saying, hey, this book taught me delegation.
Yep.
And that was... delegation was the hardest thing for me to learn. I've run multiple companies in the past, so I've had the CEO hat a few different times, and delegation was that key thing where it was hard as hell for me to learn. But when I did, I started seeing immediate success. My company just, you know, skyrocketed at that point.
Yep.
And like you said, you had that 70% rule. Like that's really the big mental hurdle, right? Because it's, I could do this job better. I could do this job faster. I could do it, whatever. But these guys aren't going to do it as well. And you get that. And I'm an engineer by heart.
So
it would drive me insane.
Yep. Yeah. And then that's the problem. You know, I say, like, CEOs, we're exceptional people. Like, it's not being unhumble, but you're like, you got to this big job for a reason. Like, either you were smart, or you worked really hard, or you're like really some chunk of reasons. So when you compare other people to you, it's not a fair comparison, because otherwise they'd be the CEO. Like, they'd be running the joint, not you.
Yeah.
And so the idea of the 70% rule, which is to say when somebody's 70% as good as you might be in a job, it's time to delegate it to them. It's like giving you permission to say, okay, that's close enough that I got to get it off my plate. Because when we walk around, I've seen it, CEOs go, they've got to be as good as I am, or why would I ever give it to them? Like, you will never delegate anything.
Your business will just plateau.
You're going to limit the growth of your company if you do that.
Yeah, and for me, that's when I get the most burnout, right? When I'm plateauing and I'm struggling to get past that ceiling for whatever it is, and it's because I'm not delegating the tasks out properly.
100%. And I think one of the things to remember is a task that, you know, is a relatively lower value task for you, because we could talk about how you figure out what to delegate in a minute. But if I send that to somebody else and it's like, it's kind of not worth my time, but we should still get it done, for somebody working for you, it's a developmental opportunity. They're like, oh man, the boss just gave me this big job, and like, he trusts me to take care of it, and I'm learning all this new stuff. And like, you just developed an employee, which is exactly what we really should be doing. So you lost a low value project. They gained a lot of cool experience that makes them a better employee. So
100%. And we see that we do computer security development and implementation services. And I've seen that exactly, right? So like, my guys, I can see they'll get burned out doing the same remedial tasks over and over and over again. And then I'm doing something crazy new, exciting. Like, let's say I'm doing some blockchain development stuff. It's crazy hard. It took me a year to figure it out. And I'm like, oh, only I can do it. And that's when I was like, nope. Got to take that off. So I go to my guys, like, hey, you guys want to learn blockchain stuff? They're like, oh, that sounds cool. I'm like, great. You spend the next 2 months learning it and I'll help you. I mean, I could have done it in a week, but it doesn't matter, because now I can delegate more tasks to them.
Absolutely. And now you can go learn AI.
Yeah. And that's funny, because that's what I'm doing.
Right?
I've been doing some deep, like, hardcore AI studies, like, for a long time, and it's now I can finally have the time to actually really focus on it and spend, you know, like, the get into the flow of it all, right? So this way there's no distractions, and I'm really, and now I can absorb it way faster. So it's freed me up, which has been massive.
It's cool. Yeah, and I talk about in the book about these hats that you're supposed to wear as a CEO, and learner is one of those hats, right? So what you're doing is like, let me get ahead of the pack, figure out what's next, and then bring it back to the tribe, if you will, and teach them. And then I'll go out and find another one and bring it back, and another one and find it back. That is right. Super high value work, because like every time you do that, you toggle up the capability of the organization to the next level, right? And yeah. You don't have to be around. I've taught them. They know how to do it. They've got it. I'm off finding out the next one, and they're executing the wheels off it. It's perfect. So right. that's really good CEO behavior.
And your five models that you have, I think the first thing I thought of when I started reading that, and you started talking about, you know, the learner, the architect, the player. Sorry, I can't remember.
Engineer and coach. Good job.
Thank you. So it reminded me a lot of the E-Myth. And when I was reading through this book, I'm like, man, I wonder if you've ever read this book. I'm like, I'm sure you have. And then you reference it later in the book. Yeah. I'm like, oh, well, it makes perfect sense. So I feel like if anyone's ever read E-Myth, this is the perfect book that comes right after that, that really goes into more detail as to how you can execute on kind of the theory that they talked about.
Yeah, I love the E-Myth.
Yeah. And it's crazy. This book is so small. And I mean, but I can tell you, like, I have, like, I just sit here in the back. I've just been writing crazy notes as I read through this thing. And I bought it twice, actually. I couldn't find the actual physical book anywhere. So I downloaded it on Nook on my iPad. So I was reading it on there first. And then it's like, I really like reading the book. So that's like my thing. And then I found the book. I'm like, oh, so I ordered it. And I'm like, I'm just going to start from scratch again. So I read the whole book all over again.
Wow.
And there's just so much gold in here, compressed, like page after page. It's amazing. You did such an amazing job.
Thank you. Yeah.
And I love it. It was funny when I was doing that first, like that minute, just kind of review, just because I really want other people to read your book because it's so good, that, you know, saying, hey, you got to find those kinks, unravel the kinks, and then put the process in place, make sure they're coming back in place. And my guys were asking me, like, did you mean to say kink? Is that the right word? Is that are we doing this? And I was like, yeah. And then I looked at your LinkedIn profile, and you have the kinked hose right at the top. I'm like, this is exactly what I'm talking about. And it's
right.
So true.
It is.
It's the perfect metaphor.
It is. Like, yeah, so for those that haven't heard it, is the idea is in any system you can name, there's a kink in the hose, right? In other words, something that constrains the ability of the whole system to operate. You know, like software programmers, you know, debottleneck code, and network managers, you know, figure out where the flow, the data flows are, and figure out where they need to put more capacity in place. Same exact model. So in a hose, if there's a kink and the goal is to get water, you got to find the kink and open it up. Well, in a business, somewhere in your business, there's a kink. It could be sales, it could be marketing, it could be talent acquisition, it could be who knows. Your job as a CEO is find the kink and open it up. It's funny, you mentioned the five hats. This is bonus material, it's not in the book. The two hats that are used to find the kink are player and learner or analyst.
Makes sense.
So when I'm either diving in and doing, and while you're doing, you're like, boy, this doesn't make sense the way we do it. We ought to do it some other way. This is really horrible. That's all learning about where the kink might be. Also analytics, like what's next? You know, how's the data performing? What do the KPIs look like? That may help you find the kink. And then fixing the kink, it's the architect, the business model. Who am I doing for what? Mm-hmm. What's the margin? So forth. Coach, I got the right people around the table and they're trained properly. Or engineer, the processes we use to deliver value are either working or not working. So find the kink is player learner. Fix the kink is architect, coach, and engineer, which is not in the book. If I write version two, that'll be in the next one.
I'll be the first one to buy it. Awesome. I promise, because I'll take whatever extra content I can get. Yeah, and also like what you mentioned with the kink is about how once you've, you know, find it, fix it, but also put the process in place to ensure it doesn't come back again. Like, to me, that's a huge part of it as well, because as you know, if you fix the problem, it's like, okay, you got it, and then a month later the bad habits get back in place, and you gotta have something in there to make sure. Like a buddy of mine, he has a plant tissue culture lab down in Texas, and they have to take they're called cuts off the plants. They take these little tiny spindles and they have some super sharp razors. And he's got an SOP. After every 30 cuts with a razor, you got to get a new razor because it's just too dull.
Wow.
So it has to be extremely, extremely sharp. Well, the other day, someone was putting the razor and they did it wrong backwards and they jammed the razor right through their hand. Had to go to the ER, get a bunch of stitches. So now there's a whole new process in place to alleviate that kink as to how forceps need to be used to put the razors in the scalpels now.
I joke that every standard operating procedure has a name behind it and a story if you just knew the story, right?
100%. Like, I like figuring that out sometimes. You read like some business, some crazy rule, like, okay, someone messed up somewhere real bad or this happened. That's why this
I've
is
asked
in
that
place,
before.
For
like,
sure.
I'll hear a rule. I'm like, okay, who was it? Like, what happened? Because there's a reason you got this crazy rule in there.
Yeah, it's like, this isn't something you should have to write down, but apparently it is.
You do.
So you mentioned also about the like KPIs and metrics. You have to have, you need to know your numbers. I think every CEO knows, like, you got to know your numbers back of your hand, right? This shouldn't be something you have to figure out. It should be consistently getting, what kind of KPIs would you say have you found to be kind of the most, I don't want to say relevant, maybe the most important or that have offered the most benefit overall and from like a high level?
Yeah, I think we can get really wrapped up in metrics, right? There's so many numbers around our businesses that, you know.
Right.
So I like to start with my first couple of metrics are, what do customers care about? Like, what would a customer say, boy, if you were good at that, I'd pay you money for it. That's probably a KPI in there somewhere, whether that's on-time delivery or hitting budget on the project or response time or like customers care about that. I'm like, that's probably worth measuring. And then I don't mind some financial metrics. They're a little backward looking, but I'm good for some of those. They're kind of like an outcome of doing everything else right, so I don't get too bent on them.
Right.
But then I also like some forward-looking strategic metrics. In other words, if we continue to do well on these things, our strategy is going to be well executed and we're going to continue to grow or achieve our objectives, whatever they might be. I'll give you an example. Yeah. I was trying to penetrate Europe, one business I was running in the telecom space. And, revenue wasn't there, but I said demos are. So I'm going to measure demos and then trial purchases, like the first piece of equipment or two in Europe. And as long as those numbers are going in the right direction, theoretically, in the right amount of time, revenue will follow and repeat customers will follow. And so I measured a very, very early sign that was completely non-revenue correlated, but it said the strategy is starting to work. So I actually made that one of my KPIs. Right. So there's an example of kind of a forward-looking KPI. It says we're heading in the right direction or not. So I like those. Customer, a little bit of financial, and some forward-looking strategic. As I get into processes, I'll go deep. But at the top, like exact level, those would be the kinds of ones I'd like to look at.
Nice. That definitely makes sense. Another option another thing you talk about here is building moats.
Yeah.
And when I first started reading this, I was like, okay, this is interesting. I need to build a fort. I'm like, why? I'm like, I want people to come in. I want people to talk to me. And then when I obviously read further, it's like, makes perfect sense. You want to build up your business so that you have enough high barrier of entry for other people to try to take out your market share, right? And at least give you that advantage in some
100%.
Way.
100%. And this is actually a Warren Buffett comment. He says, if I was given a choice between growing my business and making more money 1 year or increasing the size of my moat, making the business more defensible, harder to replicate, I'd rather make a bigger moat because that's going to pay off over time. So this is where you get phrases like hard is good. Right. So they go, oh, this AI stuff is really hard. I'm like, when somebody comes to me and says that, I go, fantastic. And then it's hard for everybody. Right. Or like, it's going to take us 18 months to win that client. I'm like, perfect. Because it's going to take everybody else 18 months to try to take it away from us. So hard. Yep. When you think about moats, you think hard is good because it makes it hard for somebody to replicate your business. And if you're solving hard problems, you should make more money than solving easy problems on average.
True. Yeah, there's less people, right? It's just supply and demand. And that's kind of how we got into the whole identity access space is back in the day, 20 years ago. There was nobody doing it. Everyone needed it. And it was seemingly an impossible task. And it would take a year and a half just to install this stuff if you knew what you were doing. So it was, no one wanted to do it. So I was like, I'll do it. So it's when we kind of jumped in.
Perfect,
there.
Perfect. Yeah.
But it's, I love the idea of thinking of business of a defensive strategy in the IP and your techniques and what you're building to keep people from trying to encroach your business.
Right? Yes.
So with along with that, you've also mentioned, you know, it's not the large that eat the small, it's the quick that eat the yep. slow. And I definitely agree, but what about something where, like, let's say in an IT business, we could have someone, like, we could be super, we're small, right? We're not Google, so we could create products real quick and get things to market pretty quick. But at that same time, because Google is big, couldn't they just double down, hire 20 developers, build what took us 6 months, they build it in, even it took a year, but then they come out to market and say, look what we did, and then instantly they just suck the market share out from us. So wouldn't that still be big eat the small?
Well, yeah, but the world's a big place, right? So, you know, if you... True. I actually would love that. My answer would be, isn't that interesting? We came up with a new technology and Google thought it was cool enough that they had to go copy us. They're now dancing to our music. Isn't that interesting, right? And all they did was just validate yeah. what I did. I mean, you know, Coke sells more because Pepsi exists. So it's okay to have a competitor enter the market and validate the fact that you have the right idea here. And, you know, Google can't take all the business. Lots of people don't like to do business with Google. So I'd be thrilled if that happened, because it goes, just validated my strategy, just created buzz in the market. And every time they go create energy around that idea, I'm going to roll in and take my share behind them. So love it. Like, you go. So, but you see it in technology all the time. Like, you know,
oh, yeah.
a new technology obsoletes an old technology, right? So it happens all the time.
Yeah. And when we're trying to create new products and innovate new ideas, a lot of times we're looking out there like, hey, is anyone else doing this? And there'll be times when I'm talking to people where they're new, let's just say they're new to business. They haven't sat in a CEO role very long or a startup role, I guess probably the best way to say it. And they're like, look, I only found one other company doing this, maybe two. And I'm like, awesome. So someone's already validated that you can make money doing this and there's a customer base. So now we just need to do it better and take more customer base from them.
You got
it. Like, to me, that's kind of like what you're saying. It just revalidates, like, this is something right. we should be doing.
Yep. Yep. And it's like, if you ever watch Shark Tank, the valuation changes based on how far along the risk curve you've gotten. I've got an idea. That's mm-hmm. got one value. I've got a prototype. That's a little more. I've got one customer, a little more valuable. I've got 10 customers, a little more. I've got 10 customers and they bought a couple of times. Okay, you've now got me to, like, there's a real market there and there's a real product. So having a competitor, even a couple of small ones, says there are enough customers that this might be interesting for us, right? Yeah, I love that
True.
Idea. Let others lead and be a fast follower. Like, I'm not going to go out there and bloody myself on it. I'll let somebody else do that and then I'll come in right behind them.
Yeah. There's a ton of money in being number two.
Yeah, totally.
So another thing you mentioned was getting out there, traveling to learn, kind of get out of your little fiefdom that you live in and see how other countries, other companies are doing things. I have lived by this my whole life. I travel frequently as much as I can to the craziest places around the world. And I just try to talk to people when I go, like, hey, how do you solve these problems? What kind of issues do you face when you see this type of things? And it's given me amazing ideas that I can then come back with. And even it's like, I may be talking to a beauty salon owner in Cambodia, but the way that they interact with their customers and they get just repeat customers and everyone's so happy. It's like, oh, I've learned one little technique that I can then go to my customers and it makes them super happy that I can do with. And it elevates my business just that little bit more. And I never would have gotten that unless I went to that hair salon in Cambodia,
nice.
You know? So it's like, I definitely love the idea about traveling to see how other people and other cultures address the same problems mm-hmm. or issues, you know, and how they kind of resolve
them. We say this in, you know, we build these CEO advisory boards, peer groups, and we say that breakthrough thinking doesn't come from inside your industry. Y'all grew up the same way. Y'all got the same education. Y'all got the same experiences. That's breakthrough thinking comes from outside your industry. So outside your geography, outside your industry, because that's where you see this. Hair salon in Cambodia has an idea that nobody in your industry has. And you're like, dang, that's a great idea. Why didn't I think about it? And, you know, you just, so yeah. I'm all over. You got to get outside of your comfort zone and outside of your industry. Like, when people say, oh, I learned tons, I go to my industry association. I'm like, nothing incredibly yeah. creative will ever happen at an industry association meeting ever. So.
And I've always found there's a really good product niche in the Venn diagram of when you have two completely different industries and wherever that weird overlap is. So it's like I own a tattoo shop down in Puerto Rico as like kind of like a hobby. It's been open for like 12 years now. So it's been around a while. But I take the business acumen that I've learned from my IT security company and bring that down there to help run the tattoo shop industry. But then there's things that I've learned from constant, because we have way more customers, right, in a tattoo shop than I am in an enterprise business type sales position. So we can practice different sales techniques way faster down there. So I've learned a lot from that to be able to take back up here. So there's definitely a lot of exchange between different types of business. So I think that's a great idea too.
I actually own part of a CrossFit gym, and some of the same learnings about building community and recruiting versus retention. And I totally hear you on that one.
Yep. So you mentioned about how it's really good to put together the board so you can get those ideas from the outside. So you mentioned there's like you start out with like an advisory board and then you kind of move to the board of directors based on the company growth. One question that I'm so glad that I get to ask you, because I was like, I really wish I could ask this question. So when is a good time to build an advisory board, and when is a good time to move to board of directors? Like, is it a company size? Is it what kind of those decisions make you say, okay, you know what, let's build that advisory board. We're at that point now.
I think, and by the way, CEO peer groups are an alternative to an advisory board of building your own. So let me just put that out there. But something like that, an infrastructure around you as a CEO, I think when you are the early stages of, I've never done this before, is when you should do it, right? So if you built business to 10 or 20 million bucks and you're kind of there, you're like, you may not need that kind of help. But if you're at 30 or 40, you go, uh-oh, never done this before. I need help, right? I need some brains that are not my brains helping me with this thinking. So I would say early stage of when you haven't done it before. And we run into entrepreneurs, they get to a certain size and they go, I was comfortable up to X. And now I know I'm way over past my headlamps and I need help. Advisory board time. Relative to moving to a more of a formal fiduciary board, that's pretty formal. That's when there's a lot of processes in the business. You've probably got an executive team in place. Certainly when you bring in outside capital, you need that governance to be in place.
I think mandatory. Because they want a board seat.
I think it's also a readiness for sale thing. When you're thinking about possibly selling, a board can be really helpful as you contemplate that to make sure things are done right, risk is well managed, you don't have any blind spots. And, if you get a diverse board, they can help you with your strategy, right? This is the ideas come from outside your industry. They'll go, Adam, I don't know why you think about it like this. Why don't you think about it like this other way? And you go, I don't know, never did that before. And boom.
Yeah.
So bigger and more formal. I would say full fiduciary, a few hundred million, 100, 200 million is when you really need to be thinking about that. Is just a rule of thumb would be my read. You can do it earlier.
Nice. Yeah. But I think you're pretty much spot on. Like how I've been doing it is, whenever I do a startup, I always get to, I'm good until I reach to the point where I've done this before. And then all of a sudden it's like, okay, now what's the next level? And then I have a group of friends that all run larger businesses than myself and, big companies, whatever. I'll hit them up, be like, hey, let's go have a beer. We got to have some time. I need to pick your brain for a minute. And that's how I've always gotten to the next levels, by talking to people that have done it before. Like, why am I going to spend all this time and effort figuring it out and wasting money when I could just ask a buddy of mine and be like, hey, you have a tequila company, you're worldwide. How'd you break into Europe to get business? What are the things I need to worry about over there? It's like, great. I never even thought of that. Great info that way.
Spot on. That's exactly when either a mastermind group of your own that you've created, or a CEO peer group that somebody curates for you, or a board, advisory board that you build on your own. Any of those work.
Yeah. One thing that you also mentioned that I'm a big fan of is building a wow experience for your clients and your customers. And that actually started with my tattoo shop. That was the first time where I was like, when you see, because you get that immediate gratification, you've given them something and they're really happy with it and they leave. And you get to see the smile, literal smile on their face, and they're all excited and they want to tell their friends and everything and they leave. And it's like, this is amazing. Like that feeling that person has right now is the reason I know they're going to come back. I know they're going to tell their friends, we did a good job, you should check us out. And then, so from there, I was like, I need to get this in the enterprise world. But it's like, how do you make a company all excited about another company that's doing IT services. Like, who walks out and be like, man, we had so much fun with these guys. We used to be able to do different things back in the day to make that happen, but now the world has changed. So how are you seeing companies that are, like, you know, in this enterprise tier, creating a wow experience for other enterprises?
Yeah, I think it sits in the area of unexpected quality, right? So this is a Japanese concept, but they talk about if there's no toilet, there's expected quality, right? So if there's no toilet paper in the stall, you expected toilet paper and it didn't happen. I'm very unhappy it didn't happen, right? Unexpected quality would be something, if it didn't happen, I wouldn't necessarily be unhappy because I wasn't expecting it. But when it happens, you go, okay, that was really cool. So you've got to find those things that customers value that you can do for maybe not a lot of overhead, that unexpected, nobody else is doing it, and they go, okay, that was super cool. I'll give you an example. Small thing. We hired a speaker, Jay Baer. He's really good at this customer experience stuff. And after we hired him, we paid Jay a bunch of money to come and speak at an event. Afterwards, he sent a link to a firm that does a custom goodie box for you. So you got to pick your goodies and put it in the box, and it got shipped to you, and it shows up with a picture of his face on it, you know, which is fun. But it was, okay, I don't even know what it cost the guy. It was different. It made me go, okay, that was different. Nobody's ever done that. It was different. I'll give you an example. When people when people come and speak at our conferences, we give them a crystal starfish, and there's a whole inside joke to the crystal starfish. So the speakers that get it are like in the club because they got one, right? And that is different. They went there and I got my crystal starfish and I'm in the club. So little things like it's not a lot of money. It's just nobody else is doing it. That's the trick.
Right. Yep. And it's, I call that the purse hook theory. So, and again, this is bizarre, but back to my tattoo shop. Every time someone leaves, I ask them like, hey, did you have a good time? Is there anything we could have done better? And they're like, no, I mean, it's great. I really pride that. I'm like, no, seriously, like, if there's anything, if I could have a magical unicorn show up right now to take you home or literally anything, what could I do? One little thing that would just make your life, you know, a little bit better. And this one girl was like, you know, what would be cool? Be a purse hook. And I was like, I have no idea what you're saying to me.
You're
right
talking
now.
Swahili to me.
And she's like, well, in the bathroom, if you could put a hook on the wall so I don't have to put my purse on the floor in the bathroom, that would be nice. And I was like, oh, never thought of that. I don't really carry around a purse too often. So I went out to Home Depot, I bought a hook, I screwed it to the wall, and ta-da, purse hook, right? She came back with her friend, actually, about a week later, and she came out just laughing hysterically and ran up to me. She's like, there's a purse hook in the bathroom. And I was like, yeah, you said you wanted a purse hook. She's like, that's amazing. She brought in so many clients for me right after that, just because of a $5 hook that I threw up in the bathroom because one person said it would change
everything. That's crazy. It doesn't take much. I'll give you an example. Here's another example that Jay uses. You've been to CVS lately and you've got one of their receipts.
Oh, yeah.
So how long are, here's the question. Do you think they have to be that long?
Absolutely not.
Bingo.
Everyone talks about it.
For 0.001 cent worth of paper, everybody talks about their long receipts from CVS and it's a thing, right?
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. That's, I never even thought about that. And you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
That's so smart. I wonder if it was inadvertent or intentional.
Whoever did it is a super genius if they did it on purpose.
Okay, so I'm going to start sending like 20-page invoices to all my clients for now.
Yeah.
We'll print them out and mail it to them.
Going to print them out and ask. You have to decode them.
So I noticed you're working on a new book about negotiation. Yeah. I saw one of your LinkedIn posts, and it says, never say your number first. And I just saw this, and I was talking to Ian here. And I was like, this is crazy. That's been one of my fundamental things about any negotiation is you never give up your number first. Like, you lose. Whoever gives their number first loses.
That's the rule of thumb.
So can you give us a little bit of insight about your book and what kind of cool nuggets are going to be in there?
It's in process, so I can't give you everything. But, you know, the thing about the person who gives the number first is you know, you've set expectations. There's a whole bunch of things go into it. One is the use of silence, and the other is benchmarking. So the example here is, let's say I'm looking for a classic Mercedes. I'm walking down the street and I see this phenomenal, perfect Mercedes for sale and for sale sign. My guide comes out, goes, hey, interested in Mercedes? I'm like, yeah, sure. Now, I know this Mercedes is worth 50 grand, right? Mm-hmm. So I go, what are you looking for the Mercedes? And he goes, 25,000 bucks. You have two reactions to that. You know, one is done, sold, right? I'll drive it home right now. What's the second reaction? What's wrong with the Mercedes, right?
Exactly. Is the engine in it?
And so this game of he set the benchmark at 25 when I would have gone to 50. He left 25,000 bucks on. And funny enough, he actually gave me a less good experience in buying his car. So there's a way to play that game, which is benchmarking. Particularly if you know the value of something. You, let's say he goes, well, you know, I've done the research on these Mercedes and they sell for as much as 65,000 bucks, right?
Yeah.
Now he's put a little 65,000 in my head, and now we're working off of 65 instead of 25.
Yeah, like, well, I think 15,
he didn't offer me a price. He just said they go for as much as.
Yeah.
And then I go, and he goes, what do you think? What would it be worth to you? And I go, I don't know. I might do 42.
Yeah.
Because I think it's worth 50. And he said 65. So now we're playing a game on it. But I think he didn't make an offer. That was the key in it.
Okay,
now, why people don't like this is because of the silence.
Right.
And I go, what are you willing to pay? And you don't want to mention that. If you and I both have the same view of we won't mention a number first, this is going to be a very uncomfortable pause.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I'll be like, a dollar. Okay. And then they're just like, no, it's got to be more. Okay. At least we've started that conversation somewhere.
Right. And that's the answer. If you force me to do a number, I'll go way low.
Yeah. Yep. Good. Okay. I'm not crazy. That's cool. I like that. I'm getting reinforced by the experts. Cool. So you said you also do CEO like advisory panels. Is that what it is? That so? Can you kind of tell me a little bit about that? Like, what kind of services you offer from your business standpoint?
Yeah, sure. We do CEO advisory boards. They're called CEO peer groups, and this would be competitive with doing your own advisory board, like we talked about before. Mm-hmm. Except we curate them. We find the great members for you. We cluster them around you and then organize the meetings and run the meetings and make sure that the right issues are talked about when we get together. So it's sort of a done for you advisory board, better economics, better impact. And people that get to the level, they're like, okay, I've got enough humility to think maybe I need some help around me.
Yeah.
It's a great possible solution for that. CEO peer groups are great for CEOs that want to improve their performance and be with a group of like-minded people, you know, and if you want to do it yourself, that's great. But, you know, there are firms like ours that'll do it for you. And if you want to find out more, you can find it at theceoproject.com. And, you know, buy the book. Buy two like Adam did.
Yes. Awesome. Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate having your time. I'm so excited that I got to geek out with you. I'm a huge fan, and I'm going to be a lifelong fan. I cannot wait to read your book on negotiation. It's going to be gold, I already know. So thank you very much for your time. This has been awesome.
I'll make sure you get a copy of it, Adam.
Thank you.
Thanks for the time.
Oh, I'm so excited. Thank you very much. I'll see you around. Bye.